welcome to Spotlights. This is the podcast for the Yale Forum on Religion and Ecology. And as usual, I'm your host, Sam Mickey. And this week, I'm really happy to welcome onto the program, Clayton Crockett. Clayton, thanks so much for making time for us.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
And really excited to chat with you. And a little bio is in order. First, you're a professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion and the director of the Interdisciplinary Religious Studies Program at the University of Central Arkansas. And you've authored or edited numerous books, more than I'm going to list here or will be here for a while. But Religion, Politics, and the Earth with Jeff Robbins, The Future of Continental Philosophy of Religion, Derrida After the End of Writing, Radical Political Theology, Religion and Politics After Liberalism, and then most recently, Energy and Change, A New Materialist Cosmotheology. And your work is really wide-reaching. It's really exciting to me to see this kind of like interdisciplinary engagement with politics, theology, science, ecology, economics, philosophy, and including a variety of very interesting kind of postmodern or contemporary philosophers like Gilles Deleuze, Jacques Derrida, Catherine Malibu. So happy to chat with you about it. And I guess before we get into the new book, I'm always just curious to hear people's kind of origin story, how you get into this work, especially the kind of thing where you're engaging with contemporary ecological issues, but also politics, but also religion, also philosophy. Why didn't you just pick one narrow thing? That's like what you're supposed to do in academia is just hyper-specialize and focus. So what led you to have this kind of voracious appetite for this kind of work?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that I say that like theology, but non-dogmatic or non-orthodox theology is really the lens that opens up onto all these things. So it's kind of an like a philosophical theoretical interest. But then when I was in college, took a philosophy course, it was totally analytic and completely boring, right? And tedious and not really exciting for me. So the more I got into philosophy, I was reading continental philosophers kind of on my own, but also studying religion, ended up going to grad school at University of Virginia and Syracuse University, which are two of the very few places that you could actually study theology in programs that didn't have a divinity school or seminary connected with them. And so really, mostly at Syracuse, right, what was called radical theology, and this was with Charlie Winquist, who was considered a postmodern theologian and successor to the death of God theology, kind of like this was a way to read continental philosophy in ways that sort of looked for, you know, what's really, really significant and important about these, what's really going on. And so Winquist was reading Deleuze, and I studied Deleuze, Derrida, a lot of these folks, Heidegger, and ended up doing a dissertation on the Kantian sublime, which was important at that time in the early 90s, mid-90s. And so then from there, kind of instead of like staying with Kant or staying with the sublime, like I shifted that whole problematic to like Freud and psychoanalysis. If that makes sense, you know what I mean? Like instead, and working against that hyper-specialization. And I think if I was at an R1, I probably would have been forced to continue to be more specialized. But being at a more comprehensive school, you know, mid-level state school like the University of Central Arkansas, I didn't have as much support for my research, but I had a lot more freedom. So I kind of was able to do whatever I wanted. And what I wanted was, you know, just to kind of see what opened onto what. And so getting into political theory, including political theology, and then eventually into, you know, issues of energy. And it was really kind of around the middle of the first decade of the century with when, you know, peak oil, thinking about resource scarcity, depletion, and then starting to think about energy in relation to all these other kinds of things that kind of brought me to just the sense of trying to, you know, wrap my mind around what I wanted to do with this book, which really draws together so many of these interests, as you say, some going back further and some much newer.
Nice. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting paradox in a way that when you're at a university that doesn't really support your research as much, the upside of that is you actually have a lot more freedom. And so you can explore things as they interest you and pull together different threads. And so I feel that way as an adjunct. Mm-hmm. So I'm not, you know, technically like a full-time professor, And people are like, oh, that's unfortunate. I'm like, actually, it's allowed me to do a lot of writing that I like and or to spend time podcasting and things like that. And so, yeah, kind of a weird, weird paradox. And I'll tell you, I've been following your work for a while. And when somebody's thinking about the intersection between things like thermodynamics, theology, and politics, I'm like, I don't understand those things. You've always been kind of my go-to source for that. So the new book, it was really exciting to read because it's just kind of putting into more concrete and comprehensive form this whole trajectory of your work. So so yeah, let's chat about it. Energy and Change, A New Materialist Cosmotheology. I knew it was going to be good right from the get-go because you open up with a line from Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower. And I'll read it. It's very, very short. All that you touch, you change. All that you change changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change. And of course, normally we think of God as eternal and not changing. And that's exactly the kind of polarity that you're cutting across here. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about change. Like, what's the focus? How does energy relate to change?
Yeah. So, I mean, if we think about energy as force, right? And looking at, for me, studying energy across multiple thresholds or multiple levels, including, you know, physics, thermodynamics, biology and life, economy, economics, psychology, and then you know, something like spirit or theology, trying to think about change. One of the things that some, you know, people who study energy say is, we don't know what energy is, but energy is what measures change. And so then the question is, you know, well, what is change? Well, change is what we can understand is what's deepest and most sort of unavoidable about reality, although there's so many attempts to not acknowledge change or to try to limit change or to try to stop it. And I'm just kind of trying to say, like, well, what if we kind of go all the way, right? But also think about change as exchange. And this is one of the things that from Malibu's work, Catherine Malibu's work on first plasticity and then epigenetics and epigenesis. But as a thinker and philosopher of change, change is always exchange, thinking about exchange in these kinds of philosophical and economic and ecological terms, but then relating change to energy or thinking about energy along the lines of change, almost like a back and forth, right? You know, like a polarity, but not an opposition in any way. And so, yeah, if we're gonna, in a kind of, you know, radical theological, non-sectarian, non-dogmatic lens, think about something like God, I'd say God is change, even though most of what Western Christian historical traditions from the Greeks to the present have tried to say, well, God is what doesn't change. God is what resists change, even though that gets qualified in some interesting ways at different times and places. Right. So I'm like, well, what if we say God is change and then energy is kind of this, how we think about being, right? Being is energy transformation, which is always dynamic, always in process and never kind of static or still, at least, except in some sort of apparent provisional way.
Right. Yeah. And you know, one of the things that really gets me when we're talking about energy is just how much that concept has changed over the millennia. And you trace that history very well. So I wonder if you can speak to that a little bit, because I think when we think of energy now, we think of, you know, E equals MC squared or joules and kilowatt hours and things like that. But then when you go back, it's a much more robust concept. We need people like Aristotle.
Yeah, I mean, Aristotle kind of coins the term in Greek, like energeia, and what he's trying, you know, it's how Aristotle's trying to think about this kind of, like, again, dynamic duality between what's active and what's passive. And so as a kind of active force, this kind of energetic energeia seems to be kind of like what we think of as more like kinetic energy now. But then in some ways, ultimately, it incorporates both the active and the passive in terms of Aristotle, or the potential, right? In terms of the thinking of a prime mover or of a kind of God. But it tries to, you know, the energy, the energeia is this active force, but then again, it kind of comes to a limit or comes to an end. So it's both how Aristotle understands change, but then change is contrasted with what doesn't change. And so thinking about throughout, you know, at least in term, you know, get into the modern time and you get interesting things happening with Leibniz and then really crucially with the 19th century and the Industrial Revolution and the steam engine, and you start to think about, right, energy in terms of heat and the extent to which it's possible to design a perpetual motion machine, which they know is impossible, but then how can you get the most efficient engine?
Right.
And then heat becomes not energy, but then characterized as what sort of escapes that kind of useful work as like entropy. And so eventually later in the 19th century, you get these three laws of thermodynamics. And again, you already have distinction between energy as both potential and, you know, dynamic or kinetic or actual, right? And so thinking about thermodynamics as a way to sort of encapsulate this in terms of laws, and then energy becomes, and this is the first law of thermodynamics, energy is a conservation law. So energy is always conserved. So it only makes, we don't know what energy is, but the only way to make sense of how we, again, thinking scientifically, measure, understand, make sense of the world, is to posit that energy is always conserved. It can't be created or destroyed in any interaction, in any exchange, right? So that's the first law. The second law is then, okay, but there's always kind of a loss of useful energy in any sort of situation. And again, the paradigmatic relationship here or example is a kind of engine, a steam engine, and then later the internal combustion engine. But how can we have the biggest gradient difference between something that's really hot and something that's really cold, like a sink, in order to do the most work? And the most useful work is defined in terms of productivity. And then the heat that gets lost is what can't be captured or can't be used in any kind of process of production. So something gets lost inevitably, right? Yeah. And that's entropy. And so then the second law is, in any kind of process, at least in a kind of a quote closed or quasi-closed system, entropy tends to increase. And at first that's like, okay, this is just a law. This is how things happen. But later, as so many scientific laws get understood, it's a statistical process, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're talking about molecules and we're talking about the movement of molecules that generate heat. So this happens around the turn of the 20th century. And Boltzmann is the one that kind of makes these things statistical, right, in terms of the laws of entropy. And then, but that's around the same time as Einstein's writing. And then you have relativity, and then energy gets correlated with matter in terms of mass. And all of a sudden, you can't separate something like mass from something like energy. Mass or matter is like this very concentrated, powerful form of energy. And then with quantum physics and the atom, you know, you start to open that up in very powerful and provocative ways. But what I came to understand, or what I came to think, is how this 19th century thermodynamics kind of sets how we think about thermodynamics. And again, thermal in terms of heat.
Right.
So heat becomes the preferred gradient differential, the preferred gradient. Like everything gets understood with like temperature as the basis. Let's say temperature as the basis, and then measuring that is heat, right? Or the absence of heat. So that's the third law, right? Which is that there's an absolute zero degrees Kelvin. And it's Thomson, Lord Kelvin, who comes up with the three laws as we most usually understand them or know, you know, remember them. So it's really these three laws of thermodynamics, and then Boltzmann does this in terms of a kind of probability, and then we just kind of forget that.
Right.
And so then energy loses a certain kind of specificity, and then certain things happen because energy gets caught up in quantum physics, but quantum physics is so abstract and so hard to understand and hard to make sense of. And then you have information theory, with Claude Shannon, developing closer to the middle of the 20th century. And information uses a concept of entropy, which takes like Boltzmann's laws as a way to calculate entropy, but entropy in relation to information, which is different from entropy in relation to energy. Right. So like something changes and all of a sudden you're starting to think about the encapsulation of information in terms of bits and then relating that to how we understand, how we conceptualize reality, existence, et cetera, the formalisms. Right. And energy kind of gets lost a little bit. But then you also have this what I'm trying to, you know, like try to look at during the 20th century, a kind of a non-equilibrium dynamic, you know, thermodynamics that's not based on a closed system at equilibrium. Ilya Prigogine, probably the most famous or well-known of these people that study this, talks about these dissipative systems. Right. And so when you think about dissipative systems, when you think about dynamic systems, theories of complexity, things like that, looking about how energy flows, and then thinking about how entropy becomes less about the loss of structure, the loss of order, like a kind of heat death, although that's still part of the popular mind, but it becomes more like something that way that we can talk about a kind of gradient, reduction of gradient differentials. So again, temperature is a gradient, pressure is a gradient, density is a gradient. You have these gradients that get set up, like something high and low, and then there's something that forces that or pushes that to be reduced, to collapse. And that seems to work towards a kind of equilibrium right. in some ways, right? But in very specific cases, that actually produces something like structure, pattern, or order. And so reading that, and then also reading Deleuze, and I've been studying Deleuze for a long time, but difference and repetition, like it was like at the sort of early in chapter 5, he talks about this kind of transcendental illusion of entropy. And he's talking about things in terms of like mostly like intensity, a kind of intensity and extensity and this kind of asymmetrical synthesis. And what I was able to see is that in many ways, he's providing a kind of theorization or philosophical understanding that makes sense or is compatible with the stuff that I was reading in terms of non-equilibrium thermodynamics. Right. And so, like you said, I trace some of that in the first chapter, and I try to use Deleuze in relationship to some of these newer ideas and newer findings and things like that, in order to give us a new way to think about energy and entropy and dynamics and thermodynamics. And so in these cases, it's not just reduction of gradient differences leads to equilibrium, leads to disorder, leads to loss of structure, leads to heat death, things like that. But in certain circumstances, right, creates, and as long as there's energy flow through a system, creates and maintains structure, order, patterns, things like that. And you can see this in other kinds of disciplines as well, including environmental sciences, including biology, including even economics, which is really fascinating and interesting.
Yeah, so fascinating. Yeah. And the way you are able to pull all these threads together is just incredible to me, especially doing it in relatively short space. It's not like a 10-volume book.
Yeah.
And easily could be. But, and I know like Deleuze uses the term, I think it's from James Joyce, that we live in a chaosmos. Mm-hmm. And so the opposition between chaos and cosmos, or order and chaos, has really kind of broken down. There's no longer that dualism. And just fascinating to me. And of course, I mean, this is so much of the modern world is built on this new understanding of energy. Mm-hmm. And I mean, what the Industrial Revolution did to society and to the planet, I don't think we have fully digested that yet. And so, I mean, you get into this in terms of talking about political economy and political ecology as well. So how does all this kind of thinking about thermodynamics and quantum physics and things like that, how is that relating to our economic system?
Yeah. So I mean, I try to go back to the way, and again, in the 19th century, what's thought of as a political economy, and then the way in which in the 20th century, those get split apart and economics gets kind of formalized and mathematicized and like classical, neoclassical economics, where it gets so abstracted from, you know, what's actually going on in the world, and you discount what's called externalities. You forget right. about waste, you forget about the inputs, the environment, all these kinds of things, which leads to this fantasy of you can just have, like, you know, you can have production, you can have wealth, you can generate stuff, you know, just out of our human minds and then our human labor, and forgetting about all these other resources. And so it's really, I mean, in terms of religion, there's folks in other fields that have been working on this, but a kind of new energy humanities. And then Tara Sharon Rowe spoke of modern extraction, seeing how the modern and to many extent ways that the contemporary political economy is based on a kind of extraction. So you're extracting wealth, you're extracting value, you're extracting, you know, energy out of things, right? You know, oil is huge, right? Petrology, but even she talks about a kind of petrotheology where it kind of becomes a value system about what oil does and brings, you know, again, this kind of prosperity that you get from extracting materials, extracting mineral, extracting things from the earth, but you're also extracting value from, you know, animals, non-human animals, plants. You're also extracting value from peoples, usually non-European peoples, but increasingly also, you know, the stratification of, like, you know, poorer peoples for wealth, the wealthy, the corporations, things like that. And so there's this whole paradigm or this whole understanding of extraction, which modernity works. And I'm saying that all of our technology, all of our civilization is highly dependent on energy resources, on extracting energy, on using energy, on maintaining energy, preserving it, putting it to work, all these kinds of things, which then gets theorized in some ways in thermodynamics in the 19th century. And then gets in some ways forgotten, even though these processes are still at work and even become more optimal. And so it's like this weird thing where we're finding these new, like thinking about quantum physics, right? Quantum computing, nanotechnologies, quantum technologies, and even quantum thermodynamics, ways in which to make things more efficient in terms of processing information, or also to make machines and other things work for our capitalist systems, which is also basically using up at least the ability to, I mean, it's complicated, but the resources in terms of our ability to use them is finite. Yeah. The planet that we have, right? The ecology that we have is finite in some way, shape, or form, even though we're constantly getting energy from the sun. It's an open system, but still in non-renewable ways. We're mm-hmm. using these things up. We're running into real sort of geophysical limits. And then that changes the world that we live in. There's a kind of transformation from what we could think about as, you know, capitalism, mercantile capitalism, liberal capitalism, and then this incredible acceleration, the great acceleration after World War II from like 1945 to 1970 or early 70s. And then you have this shift to a kind of finance capitalism. Mm-hmm. And you have this like a kind of dislocation of sort of the real productive economy from the financial economy to a certain extent. And an outsourcing of this economy as well. But at a certain point, you start to see to where, you know, there's an inflection point in growth, real wages stagnate, and have this concentrated wealth at the highest levels that's been continuing for the last few decades. And so now we're in a situation where I think if you have a limit in terms of growth, you can't like grow anymore so that, like in absolute terms. So the only way you can grow is in relative terms. Mm-hmm. And because of the way that capitalism set up and mutates into what Naomi Klein calls savage capitalism, you're forced to grow. I mean, whether you want to or not, right? You're forced to extract more and more wealth, more and more value from the people that don't have it, but they have a little bit so that you can maintain yours in terms of the super rich, the elites, the oligarchs, the corporations, et cetera, et cetera. And this is going on within the United States. It's going on, you know, in other countries, and it's going on across the world. And so trying to come to terms with that, which is partly what we're facing in the Anthropocene, not just global warming. I mean, we are facing global warming. We are facing climate change. We are facing these incredibly powerful and dangerous shifts in how we can, you know, live our lives in a kind of a stable, seemingly stable world, which has never been stable, but been relatively stable for the past 10,000 years or so, in which you allow have this little window for human civilization. But we seem to be bringing that to an end. And so then you have a lot of, crisis going along with that.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, with neoliberal capitalism, it's global warming is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the crises we're facing. And I think that's one of the important things about the discourse around the Anthropocene is to be like, you know, no, all of human history, human civilization was within the Holocene. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our Pleistocene times, that wasn't really the historical period. That wasn't civilization as we know it. And so this is the first time within human history that we've shifted geological epochs. So that means so many things. And it can be frustrating when people are just like, well, yeah, global warming is the name of the crisis. Like, oh, if only. Mm-hmm. It'd be so much easier. And and even the shift away from fossil fuels toward renewables. But if renewable energy is still being modeled on an extractive economy, then it's going to still perpetuate a lot of these crises.
Yeah. And I mean, we're locked into fossil fuels in so many ways. And yet, even right when we experiment sort of beyond that, you still have the same neoliberal economy, the same extraction of wealth. I mean, even when we're talking about, you know, nuclear energy, even if we're not building bombs, what we're doing is we're producing fissionable material in order to heat water to turn a turbine, right? To steam to turn the turbine to generate electricity, which is the same kind of way that we've been doing. And it's not even as efficient as it was, although now it's becoming less efficient with some of these other sources. And so we're desperately trying to find new energies that have maybe less emissions, but we can't really scale them, right? On small scales, it's like, yeah, this is great. You know, geothermal, yeah, we can do wind. Yeah, we can do these things. They can be a little bit of a piece, but it also seems like it's a small thing if you're looking at this in a large scale system and globally, right? And it also seems like we don't have the political will or even the imagination in so many ways to transform in the way that we would need to transform, even if it's not too late to transform. Yeah. And the ways in which all these things are in these feedback loops. So like you said, and Elizabeth Colbert talks about the sixth extinction, the rate of extinction, background extinction of species, at least 100 times that of the background rate in terms of, you know, right now, non-human animal species. And the rising sea levels, the ice melt, the ways in which we're losing fresh water, access to fresh water, the acidification of the oceans, not just the rising seawater, not just the warming, but the acidification, the loss of arable land, the you know, it's harder and harder to mine these, like, you know, and more destructive to get these resources, these rare earth metals that we all need for our phones and everything like that. And so, yeah, it just you're in this situation where if you think about it in a certain basic way, you can't have infinite growth with a finite resource base. Yeah. And everybody would know that. But yet so much of capitalism is about convincing ourselves that somehow that's possible. Somehow we can have a miracle. Somehow the miraculous, again, usually Eurocentric, Western, whatever mind that created this is going to find a solution to this, a magic bullet, which seems incredibly illusionary, right? It seems deluded in many ways. And yet, or we just deny it because we can't face what's happening around us.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah. And it's like, we know it factually. If you say, well, I don't think you can have infinite growth on a finite planet. Yeah. People are like, yeah, I understand that, but I'm not really taking that to heart and not really adjusting my life accordingly, because that would change everything. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you hear like degrowth advocates, And people are like, degrowth, you're going to kill us all. And, you know, they just get so dramatic about it because it's like we're so committed to this idea of endless growth. And that people think like there's no other way. Yeah. And of course, one of the things you're doing in the book is precisely saying there are other ways, and it requires us to expand our imagination about what energy is. Mm-hmm. And like you say, it's like, well, we don't really know what energy is, but there are ways of imagining it that can help us reframe our relationship to resources, our economic system, our relationship to other humans. And one of the exciting things, you know, I did a little work with Vodou and West African religion for my master's thesis. And so I was so excited to see that you engage with that in the book, and you situate it alongside other non-European ways of thinking about energy, Amerindian traditions, Chinese traditions. So what's going on with energy outside of this Eurocentric frame?
Well, and nothing happens in a vacuum, right? But we need to try to understand and think about what I call non-modern or non-Euro-modern traditions, ways of thinking, practices, and at least like, you know, what's going on there and what can they tell us about what we're doing and also maybe what we're not doing and what possible avenues do they open up. So I talk about new materialism. There's a kind of like with Karen Barad and Bruno Latour, a kind of agentialism, but we could also think about a kind of a new animism. And thinking about the ways in which the world, the natural world, was animated. And so somebody like Bruno Latour says, you know, we have this fantasy of this disenchanted, deanimated world, but that's kind of a conceit, or that's kind of a fantasy, because if we're thinking in terms of agency and agentialism and animism and processes and dynamic things going on, they're always going on. And the part of what the European worldview, scientific modern worldview, reacted against was the personalization of some of these forces. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, well, we can see that, and we can kind of bracket that, but then we can also say, well, what are these things doing, right? And how are they manifested? How are they being described? And how are they at work? And how, or to what extent, do they help maybe explain what's going on better, or at least in ways that potentially have a future relative to the ways in which we're doing things now. Right. And like you said, it's like, you know, that great quote from that's attributed to Jameson that Slavoj Žižek always says, it's easier for us to imagine the end of the world than doing something besides, you know, neoliberal capitalism. Yeah. And we know we need to do something different, but we don't know how, and we can't imagine how, and it's easier to have these apocalyptic scenarios. Or sometimes, even when we look at these traditions, we look at something like Vodou, we look at something like, you know, the Chinese Neo-Confucian philosophy, and even the Native American practices, it's easy to romanticize that. It's easy to say, okay, they lived in harmony with the world.
Right.
And so say no, because there's always these gradient differences, right? There's always these kinds of things that get set up and reduced, and they're doing these practices, but what about these practices is working different? And this is why, for me, Kojin Karatani's work is so helpful, because he's talking about this kind of world systems from thinking about a switch from systems of production to systems of exchange. And so when you think about systems of exchange as ways in which to organize, in which societies organize themselves, you're looking at things in a different way. And because exchange is always, I mean, it's always asymmetrical, but it is always transaction. Mm-hmm. It is always going, you know, but it doesn't just go one way. And so you're not just producing something, right? You're creating something, producing it as a commodity, and then selling it, and then getting wealth or whatever. But you're in a whole network of exchanges, and we can have a kind of quasi secular scientific way to describe this, but then we can also see how these could be described maybe more relative from inside. But I'm not trying to say this is how it is. I'm saying, like, this is one way we can kind of look at some of these processes, thinking about the Vodou Loas, right? Thinking about these, you know, spirits, gods, goddesses as energy sources, right? Or as like these crystallizations or concentrations of energy. And then when you're possessed, then all of a sudden you're taken over by something, and this kind of spirit possession, which from a certain reading sounds, oh, this is superstitious, this is, you know, occult, this is weird, this is, but like taking this much more seriously, but not trying to understand it on its own terms or adequate to itself, but thinking about it in contrast to the ways in which we've set up and understand our modern Euro-modern world and inherited that, but also, like I said, a kind of diffraction pattern between this and some of these other traditions, right, which obviously, and there's much more that I could have talked about. And even the ones I did talk about, I barely talked about. So it's like, not like I'm doing justice to any of that, but I'm saying there's some really interesting things going on that maybe, and in the example of something like Qi,
yeah,
which is usually described as like a kind of a psychophysical, energy, but it is material, but it can become spiritual because it avoids that dualism. Thinking about Qi as an energetic resource and energy, an energy exchange kind of thing, it's at least potentially non-extractive. Right. And so it's like, what kind of resources do we have to think about energy and energy exchange beyond simply like, I'm the subject, I'm the transcendent ego extracting, taking, stealing basically energy from this source, from this system, from this tradition, this people, whatever. And I mean, you always run that danger because you're appropriating, you're assimilating, you're a result of all of these things, these practices, right? But then how do you try to understand it in a comprehensive, broad enough way, but then also, where are there places that you could kind of intervene? Where are there levers? Where are there like little mm-hmm. insertions that you can kind of say, okay, what if we follow this line? Mm-hmm. And maybe I can't follow it very far, but maybe you can, or somebody else could, and kind of use that to open up a different way of seeing, thinking, which is what I do. Like, I'm a theorist. I'm trying to, you know, understand things, to think things, to philosophize, to intellectualize, but then also practices and doing things with that too.
Right. Yeah. I think for a lot of people, if you're like, well, we have an energy crisis, and I think a solution might be more people doing Tai Chi. And people are like, all right, I don't think that can't solve it. But that's one of those things of, it's so hard to imagine the end of capitalism. It's much easier to just imagine that we'll, you know, run through a sixth mass extinction event and the end of society, the end of life as we know it. And that we can do. Mm-hmm. Doing yoga and Tai Chi, no. Or spirit possession is certainly, people would be more amenable to Tai Chi than spirit possession. That's really seen as some terrible superstition or like black magic, occult, all those things you're saying. And so I like that you line up so many of those options, because it'd be one thing just to say, all right, Qi, that'll get us out of it. You're like, no, there's tons of different options, and depends where you're at and what kind of levers you can pull on to make some change. And things like the new animism, new materialism, like there's so many people who are kind of pushing in this direction. So ultimately that gives me some hope. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about new materialism, because, of course, you know, that's crucial to the book. It's a new materialist cosmotheology. Yeah. And I think we've talked about new materialism like a couple times on the podcast, but not in any great depth. I think a lot of people still associate materialism with something very reductive, or they think of materialism as like consumerism, that kind of thing. Yeah. But new materialism is such a different world.
So before I get to that, I mean, I just wanted to say, like, in relation to what you said before, one is that I'm trying to be as honest and, you know, facing like as I can about the fact that there's a great chance that we're not going to survive. It's a great chance that we are going to extinct. You know, not trying to have the kind of false hope that this is going to, right. And at the same time, you know, like, again, like at the same time, try to be as realistic as we're destroying ourselves and there's nothing we can do. And here's what we can do, because there are always possible, there are always other things that can happen. And that's kind of how my understanding of change works, right? So that, trying to hold on to both of those. And this is, going back to what you said, like the one thing I learned, not just the one thing, but one of the things I learned that's interesting about Darwinian evolution, right, is that adaptation doesn't happen in response to selection.
Right.
You don't adapt. What happens is what we can retroactively call pre-adaptations occur. Like things are random variations, like mutation is a weird word, but so like variations. There are variations. There are people experimenting with all kinds of ways of life, with ways of thinking, of doing different things, right? Even if many of us or most of us feel like we're locked into this one way of doing things with capitalism. But if the, you know, and we don't know what's going to be selected, and maybe human beings will be selected, and maybe they will, and maybe certain kinds of human beings, and maybe it'll be like a hunter-gatherer type of thing, you know, concentrate at the poles, depending on how hot it gets. But whatever it is that would allow for a kind of survival has to be happening now. People have to be doing this now, experimenting with things now, and then once this, as we're, I mean, we're in this, it's happening fast, even though it seems slow in some ways, but when the selection happens, you know, we'll see something might survive, something might be adaptive, but it's not like we're going to adapt in response to that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's an important point, because I hear a lot from people that they think like, oh, as soon as the crisis gets really bad, that'll force humans to adapt. And like, no, we don't adapt in response to the crisis. It's that we have to pre-adapt, as you're saying. And so we need people doing all kinds of experiments. And then hopefully one of those will allow for some kind of viable selection to hopefully keep our species alive and the great diversity of life that we share the planet with, you know, ideally.
As much of that as, I mean, yeah, and so much of it is dying, but we also have to confront death in a different way.
Right.
Right. So Whitney Bowman, who does, you know, religion ecology, talks about a kind of environmental hospice, thinking about South Florida and certain systems in the Everglades. And I think that there is a kind of hospice aspect to this as well, a kind of mourning, if we want to think about Derrida. So we're always mourning our own and others' deaths at the same time as we're trying to find new ways to live and be together.
So, yeah. So important. Yeah. Cause otherwise it's just, it's like you were saying, a false hope. They're like, don't worry, we're going to get our way out of this. Like, well, even if we do, we're already losing so much and we've already lost so much. So we do need to do that work of mourning and eco grief and planetary hospice work. And what's he say? Given CPR for the planet, critical planetary romanticism, CPR.
So getting back to new materialism, like something in the 1990s, it was kind of like, and again, readings of Deleuze or interpretations of Deleuze, feminist science studies. So Rosie Bradotti and Manuel Delonde are the two names most associated with this in the 90s, developing something that they call like a neo-materialism, mostly out of Deleuze's work, although there's some Merleau-Ponty and some Whitehead in there as well. But then thinking about in this century, right, this idea of a kind of new materialism gets associated with, you know, some of these French philosophers. There's the speculative realism in Great Britain, but then there's the speculative materialism of Quentin Meyesu. There's Barad's work in quantum physics. There's the Johns Hopkins school of William Connolly and Jane Bennett and Bennett's great book. And so you have this kind of like this mix of things, you know, sort of percolating. And I think Malibu at some point also associates herself with new materialism, even though she comes from a different trajectory of, like, you know, Heidegger and Hegel, Heidegger, Derrida, some kind of biological new materialism. So new materialism is basically right, trying to sort of understand the dynamic elements to material existence. Sometimes that's teleological, teleodynamic, but sometimes it's not. But there's a kind of essential dynamism to materiality in a way that goes against the sort of classic modern materialism, which is seen as very reductionistic. It's also atomistic. It's like the basic building blocks. And I mean, you know, we still have some of that. And if you think about particle physics, you know, here's these fundamental particles. And there's, you know, 23 or 46 or whatever, however you want to count them. But, and it's all Baroque. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't make sense. It's not simple, right? But still, what's the smallest particles? And then how can we build up everything from there? And if we can reduce everything, right? Or, and then the alternative to that, or the resistance to that, is a kind of vitalism or a kind of spiritualism or something superimposed. And again, we've always had inherited this kind of like two-level split existence from ancient Greece, Christianity, in some ways the modern world, whether we deny it or affirm it, it's almost always sort of implicitly there. And so, and again, non-European, non-Western traditions have not had this split in the same way, although sometimes we read them in this way, right? So thinking about that, there's a dynamism of matter that we can call spiritual, or that works against this kind of dualism, to where we don't have to say matter is static, it's inert, it's just, you know, random, blah, 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 like all that. And then, like, that's really been an important, I think, you know, English-speaking discourse, although it's, you know, penetrated, gone to other kinds of places as well. But, you know, I'm drawing on French. But what I didn't see, or what I tried to do, was kind of think new materialism explicitly in terms of energy, because I haven't seen that, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like new materialism directly talking about energy, as opposed to talking about the dynamic elements of matter and material.
Right.
And of course, with Einstein, again, E=mc², you get this correlation of mass and energy at the square of the speed of light. So there is this entanglement, there is this connection, but we haven't as much directly theorized or thought about energy in those ways. And I think partly it's also a residue of a certain kind of like new age mysticism. You know, there's crystals, there's you know, these weird kinds of things, spooky kinds of things that sometimes we want to talk about, and even quantum mechanics sometimes gets associated with the Tao of physics, and oh, it's this Eastern mysticism or this new, and I'm trying to say, no, we need to think about energy in very, you know, scientific material ways. But when you bring complexity physics into it, when you bring non-equilibrium dynamics into this, when you're thinking about this in along with the resources, both in the sciences, what's called science studies, but also now environmental humanities, ecological studies, and philosophy, you have this kind of this ability to think and to rethink energy in these interesting and hopefully useful ways. I'm you know, just like thinking about how there has been a shift to kind of thinking and rethinking energy more recently in the last decade or so, but I think that still needs to continue and be more, even more explicit. A lot of times it's critical, right? Because you're looking at how energy has been used in negative ways, right? To justify colonialism and capitalism and resource extraction and all that stuff. And I'm trying to say, how can we think about it in positive ways without just this kind of idealization that is very tempting?
Yeah, it is very tempting. I know I loved reading Fritjof Capra's Tao of Physics when I was like a teenager, and I was like, oh yeah, it all connects. And especially, I mean, I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area, so there's a lot of crystals and things like that. And it's like, well, I mean, you know, you're kind of getting there by trying to experiment with an alternative understanding of energy, but we can be a lot more scientific about it, a lot more philosophically rigorous. And I think you do that work very well, and especially to connect it to the crisis that we have as well, and to see how, you know, it's not just a fun new way to understand energy. It is a way to transform our society so that we can ideally survive in some way and learn to grieve and all that kind of work. And so I wonder, you know, with this sense of energy that kind of overcomes the spirit matter dualism. Then you have a cosmo theology. So it seems like the cosmos, God dualism is kind of falling away. So is what you're advocating a sort of pantheism then?
I mean, in some ways, and I ended up talking in the last chapter a little bit about kind of process theology's panentheism and rethinking that or thinking that through Catherine Keller's work. And then also thinking about pantheism as Mary Jane Rubinstein has theorized it. And so what Rubinstein calls like a polytheistic pantheism is something that I'm very much affirmative of, but it's less the theism and more thinking about the pan, but thinking about it as pluralistic, as differentiated. I mean, Mary Jane always says, like, you know, how are we thinking the one and the many? And how can we think, we can't think the many without the one, and we can't, but then we also need the one to think, you know, like all these kinds of ways in which the complicated ways of thinking. And so for me, in many ways, Deleuze gives me a way to try to think the many without recourse to a one, at least not a substantial one or unity, even if he calls it a kind of univocity. But what he means is a kind of plane of immanence or kind of consistency, which then is a kind of cosmology, or is a way of just saying, with early Wittgenstein, the world is all that is the case,
right?
You know, but we're not making this, like, we're not splitting it, we're not trying to kind of like divide it into this is where things happen down here and this is where things happen up there. In any way, it's just how can we think about the cosmos and what's going on in the cosmos as at once material and spiritual, as at once having to do with very brutal kinds of processes and systems of extortion, of, you know, Whitehead says life is robbery, stealing the resources of other organic and inorganic entities and beings, and also thinking about something like God, which we've inherited, and thinking about it differently. As there's a kind of death of God theologian, Gabriel Vahanian, who was at Syracuse before I was, says, you know, God is a word in the dictionary. You know, so many times we think that God means what, you know, this kind of like inherited theistic God is, this supreme being or whatever. And so it's just like, no, we don't have to do that, right? We don't have to maintain that positively or negative. We can be creative with that. And in fact, it's Lacan who says, Jacques Lacan says, you know, it's really the atheists who are the most, you know, the real theologian is the atheist who knows that God doesn't exist, but can really think God creatively, productively, right? Yeah. And so it's just thinking about divinity in terms of change and transformation, thinking about being in terms of energy and energy transformation, just felt more honest, more appropriate, more adequate, more realistic in terms of how I'm wanting to describe it. And what that does is it's knowing that we can't escape anthropomorphism, but at the same time trying to resist the tendencies to personalize something like God, to personalize something as, you know, the ultimate source of everything. Like, we don't know where energy comes from. We don't know, I mean, we can speculate, right? Where the universe comes from, if it's one of many, right? Or not. But as far as we can make sense of what is, we can make sense of using all the tools that we have, not saying we can't use this term, or we can't use this concept, or we can't have this word, but how would it make sense in terms of experience to talk about energy and to talk about change, at least for me at this level and all these different kinds of permutations. So yeah, it's not traditional, it's not orthodox, but I still think it's a kind of resonance.
Yeah, I like that a lot. It also reminds me of John Caputo's work saying God doesn't exist, there's an insistence of God.
Yeah,
and I've always been very attracted to a lot of the death of God theology and that kind of work. And I know sometimes when people start getting into theology, they're like, no, you people are ruining it. you're kind of like you're saying, it's like, well, there's like the top floor and there's the bottom floor. We're just removing mm-hmm. the top floor. Like, no, we're trying mm-hmm. to think outside of that frame. And mm-hmm. so Wittgenstein's the world is all that is the case. And it's like, so there's nothing beyond the world? It's like, no, the beyond versus world dichotomy is what we're trying to challenge here. And I appreciate they also bring up the one-many distinction in that way. That's hard. Yeah. That's hard to think.
Yeah. Yeah. So the beyond is in the world. The beyond is nowhere other than the world.
Yeah. And if that means that, you know, all that we talk about in terms of divinity is actually energy and transformation, then imagine how that would change our relationship to political economy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's exciting. Yeah.
And we have to think and rethink something like spirit, not as the opposite of matter and material physical forces and things, but as in some ways a way to value, or the way to a way to really open ourselves up to a kind of experience,
mm-hmm.
which you can experience the same thing in a spiritual way and in a non-spiritual way.
Right.
And it, you know, if we think about, you know, we think about some kind of natural scene or natural setting or an experience of awe and wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And we can say that, you know, that spirit, because it resonates with me so powerfully, and I'm also a part of it. And we mm-hmm. can also say, well, there doesn't need to be something else that tells us why this exists. So it's like not a cause, not like a first cause or a, you know, reason that has all the value. This is only a, like in terms of Plato, right? This is only a reproduction, a copy of some kind of original, which is somewhere else.
Yeah.
It's sufficient unto itself, but that doesn't mean it's contained within itself, because it's always open to all these other things and resonating with all these other things. So yeah. I don't know, just trying to work across these multiple thresholds or levels mm-hmm. without making them into a kind of hierarchy or a teleology, which with Deleuze talks about plateaus, and Deleuze and Guattari, a thousand plateaus. I like that word plateaus, because the plateaus isn't like, okay, here's a, you know, this is higher than this, and this leads to this, and et cetera, et cetera. But here's a plateau, here's a plateau, here's a plateau.
Yeah.
And in some ways, we can use this plateau in order to think all the others, and then we can move to a different plateau and rearrange them or assemble them a little bit differently.
Yeah. I like that a lot. And again, just so hard to think that way, coming out of a tradition that's been so focused on hierarchy that traces everything back to some origin point. And so kind of shaking ourselves out of that habit is going to take a minute.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you're pointing to so many resources that do that, you know, whether it's Deleuze, New Materialism, and Amerindian philosophies, Chinese philosophy, Vodou. There's just so many people who are helping us think that way. And yet it's so entrenched to not do that. And people are like, anyway, yeah, enough of the plateaus. What's the origin of all the plateaus? Like, no, there's not an origin point.
Yeah. And so we're struggling with the limits of how we think and what we can think, and trying to think as much about them as you know, ranging about them. And like you said, as resources or as possibilities or as opportunities, in arrange them in a way that makes sense, obviously makes sense for me, and I'm hoping that makes sense for you and others as well, and then spark new generative kinds of thinking, but also practical kinds of ways of living and interacting with the world and with each other. So it's a provisional kind of thing, even if it's in some ways comprehensive because of all the things that I'm trying to draw together. So
Right. Comprehensive and provisional. And I like your point also that, you know, that you're saying that the cosmos, this cosmotheological system, is sufficient unto itself, but it's not, that doesn't mean it's contained in itself. Right. I think a big part of that is then if you're open to that experience of that sufficiency, then we're not going to seek more efficiency all the time and greater productivity. And that's such a big part of our economic woes, is that we always want more, 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 and we never find enough. And to experience this universe that is sufficient unto itself, and that we're part of that, means we're sufficient unto ourselves. And then imagine how we could just relax and stop the, you know, kind of rapacious greed seeking infinite growth.
Mm-hmm. And just, you know, breathing, or like you said, Tai Chi, as a kind of sufficiency, as a kind of experience of enough. And being in relation and exchange with all these other people and all these other beings who may also be breathing in terms of respiring, or may not be breathing or being, you know, in the same way. Being open to some of those resonances and slowing down a little bit, because we're being pushed to be productive, and we're being driven to exhaust ourselves and to, you know, feel like we don't have time, and we're trying to be active, or we're trying to do these things, or we're trying to fight these fights, and we're getting burnt out, and we're getting ground down, and we're getting destroyed. And yeah, it's like, how do we still face the things that we have to face, mm-hmm. and find the resources to find the ways in which to allow ourselves the space to breathe while we can in and through them. It's not easy, but I think there's so much of, again, the commodification, the economic materialism, or the materialism in a bad sense that you mentioned, and the individualization that happens. So we get isolated in our own individualistic worlds. I think that a certain kind of Christianity supports that too, because it locates all the meaning and value in this one God, your relationship with that, and then it's all about your salvation. The only thing that matters is if I go to heaven or if I go to hell. I don't care about you. It cuts us off from everyone and everything else. And so I think capitalism, the same thing. Only thing that matters is the commodities that I can buy to make me feel good, to give me enjoyment and satisfaction and pleasure. And I need all the money to be able to buy all the commodities. But that also cuts me off from all of my relationships with everyone and everything else.
Yeah, it reminds me of something Bill McKibben said, that one of the best things an individual can do right now is stop being so much of an individual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's these extraordinary ways in which we can at least imagine or learn. I mean, I didn't talk as much about chapter two, but, and I didn't have time, like it came out after I was finished, but what's his name? Merlin Sheldrake, An Entangled Life, and thinking, you know, how to think like a fungi, you know, and the ways in which they're not individuated in the ways that we are, and really prompt him to question the idea that we have this self, that we are this self, in these profound and you know, extraordinary ways. And so we're learning so much, you know, we're learning so much about how the world works, about how life works, about how the brain works, things with technology, you know, quantum physics, we're learning so much. It's so extraordinary, and yet we're faced with this kind of dire, desperate, quasi-apocalyptic scenario that's just, you know, it feels like this, and I mean, you know, you could say always feels like this all the time, because we're always on the verge of death, but, you know, facing this, wow, this is incredible. All these things that we're exposed to, and all these things that we have opportunity for, some of which are from colonialism and modernism and capitalism. And then the ways in which that's also shutting these things down too, to grapple with both sides of that, or all sides of that, if we can.
Yeah. Right. It's very best of times, worst of times kind of situation.
As always.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, it's same as it ever was, and yet clearly different in its own way. Yeah. Well, geez, I don't want to take up too much of your time. This has really been A joy. I'm just such a admirer of your work, and really like thinking with it. It's a meditative experience that does you kind of start opening up to that possibility, to that reality. So, one other question: what's next for you?
I mean, I'm trying to kind of step back a little bit and sort of see where things settle, and not have a big project, at least at the moment. I said that I wanted to, so been doing some work connected with the Westar Institute, which is a nonprofit. They started the Jesus Seminar in the 90s. This was Ray Funk and biblical scholarship. And they started a seminar on God and the human future in around 2014. And so they got Jack Caputo connected with it. He invited me, Jeff Robbins, a bunch of other people. And so what I said, what I want to do is kind of write a less technical, a more accessible book for sort of interested intellectual readers, something like God and Energy that would be shorter, that would maybe be more readable, have a better reach. So I'm going to try to work on that in the fall because I have a sabbatical there,
Oh,
and
nice.
then just keep sort of reading, thinking, settling, and thinking about if there's something else that I want to kind of engage with.
That's great. I would definitely enjoy that book, especially because I teach students who aren't majors, teaching like core curriculum kind of stuff. And I would like to have them read your material, but it's a little dense.
It's very dense.
And it's
It's very
some of the
dense.
most, complex thinking possible, really, considering the current state of knowledge. And so if there was something just a little bit more accessible, I would definitely be using that in classes, because this is, to me, exactly the kind of thinking that we need to be doing right now.
Thanks. I really appreciate it. I love being on here. I really appreciate you and your work and everything that you're doing here and in your written books, publications. And so yeah, it's great. And I hope that I can write that for you. So
Yeah, definitely. I'll keep pestering you about
yeah,
it.
sounds like a good
Well, geez, we'll have to have you
thing.
back on sometime because there's just so much more to talk about, including some of your earlier work. I mean, the book on Derrida after the end of writing, I really appreciate because I still feel like Derrida is not being read well by a lot of people and isn't being valued as highly as he should be. So plenty to talk about. So we'll definitely have to do it again. I'll bother you when you're on your sabbatical.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks so
Cool. All
much.
right, Clayton Crockett, this was really a treat. Thank you so much for being here. And thanks for everybody else for tuning in. We'll be back with some more conversations for you soon. And in the meantime, take care and be well.
Thanks. Bye.